This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. Your speaker now is Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry. I believe this particular tape requires a somewhat lengthy introduction so that you will properly understand the context in which it came about. This tape is primarily a discussion between Dr. William Marra of Fordham University, the Roman Forum, and Keep the Faith, and many other Catholic organizations and publications, and me, Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry. My relationship with William Marra has been, shall I say, up and down. His first initial reaction to me when we first met at Catholic Rendezvous was, shall I say, at best, somewhat indifferent. I would say at that point he learned to disapprove of me, my personality, my approach to evangelism, in his opinion, self-aggrandizement. At one point, I confronted the people at the rendezvous in a talk I gave called Standing Fast, tape available from ARM, in which I essentially offered the position that the only way to resist the secularization of America was by active evangelism, and active evangelism according to my style, which is, of course, the style of the apostles and Jesus himself. I also pointed out that if one did not desire to do this personally, one had the unqualified obligation to support me in my efforts. William Marra objected to this and, to his credit, was willing to confront me with what he felt were my defects in an open and public forum that led to the tape called Professor Marra versus ARM. William Marra presented what he felt was a reasonable objection to my approach. I defended myself in such a way that he then became a mild, lukewarm supporter of ARM, later sponsoring a talk for an organization which he founded but which did not continue, and that talk was called Invitation to Confusion, also available from ARM, and also sponsoring a debate at Fordham University in front of his students, which was called the One True Church Debate. After that point, however, I would say our relationship somewhat deteriorated, and upon meeting him a short time before this particular tape was recorded, I confronted him with his obligation to continue to be a supporter of mine in my efforts and under my conditions. He essentially rejected this, although we did not have time to discuss it. I then composed a letter which I sent to him in which I accused him of essentially not living up to his faith. To summarize the letter as briefly as possible, what it says is this: Catholics, if they are to be Catholics, have an obligation to pursue the truth and to support other Catholics in pursuing, in defending, explaining, and spreading the truth. I, Vin Lewis, and my organization, All Roads Ministry, defend, explain, and spread the truth. Therefore, Catholics have an obligation, in a sense, an unqualified obligation, to help me in that effort. And as he, William Marra, has enough status, pull, influence, etc., to make my effort more well-known, more widespread, and easier. As Jesus says, to those much has been given, much will be demanded. I demanded from him a bunch of things, and I told him that I would have a list in case he wished to actually call me to find out what he could and should do. William Marra did not call me, but he did arrange for me to be invited to his house for a Christmas party in 1993. I consider this an extremely proper thing on his part, and he deserves compliments for it. It required an act of intellectual and moral courage to invite someone who has accused you of betraying the faith to come to your house and to confront that person face to face. I did not bring the subject up. I felt it might have been inappropriate, considering that William Marra had a large number of people at his house that day, including a large number of clerics. However, he brought the subject up, and since I expected that he might, I did have my portable tape recorder with me, and the discussion followed. I would like to make a few points. Number one, you will hear a large amount of background noise. That's utterly unavoidable. There were a large number of people in the house, which is not a particularly large house. They were loud, as they should be, at a party. So, therefore, there is literally nothing that can be done about the background noise. Number two, at certain points, the tape will stop abruptly. This is when William Mara was called away to handle some situation as a host or say goodbye to some guests who were leaving. Number three, at least one reference is made to Newman. This is Cardinal John Henry Newman. When we had had the discussion before, although very briefly, before this day, that my position was that Protestants are, by definition, in bad faith, and no man can remain out of the faith in good faith, William Mara raised the issue of Cardinal Newman, stating then that certainly Newman and people of his kind were certainly not in bad faith when they were outside the church. I will simply point out to you that I feel the issues brought up in this discussion, the nature of grace, the nature of faith, the nature of being outside the church, goodwill, good conscience, and the obligation for the Catholic to support his fellow Catholic, and the right a fellow Catholic has to call upon his Catholics for support. All of these issues are issues which I believe are quite relevant, of great interest, and have a very significant moral effect on one's behavior, on living one's faith, and on making one's Catholicism more than simply a sterile group of doctrinal assents to statements. In other words, what I'm saying is that Catholicism must be more than doctrine, it must be more than liturgy, it must be more than simple acts of charity. It must also be living the faith in cooperation with fellow Catholics, such as I, who seek to defend, explain, and defend the faith, and spread it, and evangelize it, and offer it, and demand that others accept it. And I repeat what I hope I have made clear in the discussion with William Mara, that those of you who are Catholics have an unqualified obligation to support those of us who do this work. You have an unqualified obligation to do it yourself. And if you don't do it yourself, the minimum you must do is to support those of us who do. With this in mind, with this context presented, I hope that you now will be able to enjoy the tape better. You will be able to appreciate it more. And the only other thing I will say is, in a certain sense, the issues were not resolved. They still were left hanging. And the tape itself ends other than what I would have wanted it to, simply because I had to leave and he was no longer able to come back to discuss the issue. At the end of this tape, I'll give a postscript giving you my version of how it ended and what ultimate resolution we came to and arrived at. Thank you for obtaining this tape. I hope that you enjoy it. I hope that you learn from it. And I hope that at times it is entertaining and enjoyable.
This will work for your memory. Hold it up. Speak into it. Is it working?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
No, no, hold it up, because the background
is okay. Well, I said I've heard you argue with Catholics, with Protestants, and so on. And
can I say goodbye first?
Yeah, God bless first. Good to see you.
See you at Mass.
Good. And I think my general criticism would be, you are a serious Roman Catholic, and you think that the evidence for Roman Catholicism is so clear that you have yourself said if there's a Protestant around, it's impossible that a Protestant be intelligent and upright and in good faith. So that every Protestant is failing at least in one of these things. Now I say that whenever you meet and you think that you have a unique apostolate, that you meet these lukewarm people who are fluttering around and always evading the issue. The minute you say good morning to someone, you already have them pinned down about why he's not a Catholic. And in that sense, I'm happy that you're taking religious truth seriously. But I think somewhat as a tactic, I don't agree that you will meet the psychiatrist that comes to the rendezvous who's a Protestant, and there are other people. Had you met Jerry Madison 2 years before he converted, or maybe 8 years before he converted, he was rather educated, and I think he was in good faith. But if there's a time for ripening in which you have to allow something to mature, and I think that you're much too curt, you cut them off, and I think that it is even counterproductive in the whole apologetic world. You know?
Yeah. Sure. First thing is, God bless him, Jerry Madoff was asked this question himself about 2 weeks ago and said when he was out of the church, he was not in good faith. He was ignorant, but it was his own fault. I also point out, okay, that, yes, I define immediately everyone who's outside the faith for one reason, personal sin, period. What I say is this, that theology and morality are utterly interchangeable. They are utterly intermixed. You cannot have a good morality. Now, I'm not talking about practice, because I
have a
good morality. And I'm not talking about practice. I'm talking about moral principles. You cannot have a good moral principle without having good theological principles. If you have good theological principles, you will have good moral principles. They are sort of like along one continuum. You cannot be a man of good faith and have bad morality. If you have good morality, you will have good faith. So therefore, utterly say that everyone who is outside the church remains outside of the church because of personal sin, period. Now, for theological justification, I was just trying to make my position clear, and I think you stated it correctly. I hold, number one, that it's not counterproductive. I'll comment on that in a moment. But what I hold until then is the following. Actual grace is of such a nature that it allows a man at every individual moment of his life, when confronted with a moral choice between good and evil, to determine what is good and enough sufficiency of grace to choose it. Every time a man says something that is anti-Catholic or non-Catholic of a dogmatic nature, God gives him enough grace to realize it is right if he seeks the truth. I also hold that the nature of man is such that he is obligated to seek the truth. So as Jesus says, ask and it shall be given to you, knock and it shall be opened, seek and you shall find. Anyone who seeks the truth will at the absolute minimum understand that what he's advocating is wrong, if it is wrong. He may not yet understand what is right. I'll even consider that theoretically, because it may require supernatural sacramental grace to accept the mysteries of the faith. But as I tried to explain to someone else before, the gentleman over here, any Baptist who reads the Bible once sees that no remarriage is allowed after divorces. He sees that his church allows and encourages it. And then he automatically knows he's in the wrong church. And I interviewed Jerry Madoff on his conversion story, and I asked him, how did you deal with these problems? And he says it was exactly why he kept leaving church after church after church. He went through about 5 different denominations because he found every single one to be defective on a clear biblical principle. So just to deal with the issues of a Protestant, every Protestant denomination allows remarriage and divorce, every single one. Jesus condemns it, forbids it, without qualification.
There is an ambiguity. Jesus said, if you put away your wife, and then in parentheses, there are various translations, but I do not speak here of uncleanness. So the Protestant will depend on that ambiguity, some of them, for a bona fide possibility of marriage, of divorce and remarriage.
Except for the following. You will never, listen to me, never, I repeat this with tremendous emphasis, never, never, never find a Protestant quoting Jesus in preference to St. Paul, except on this one issue. Because if you read the writings of St. Paul, he makes it exceptionally clear that for a Christian, there is no exception whatsoever. And as you say, that is an ambiguity which can be translated certain ways. If you find that every Protestant minister interprets the words of Jesus in light of what St. Paul teaches, except for one exception, and then it's an ambiguity. But if you read the writings of St. Paul on this, he says, you may separate while you're alive, but you may never, 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 never marry again. So there's no ambiguity whatsoever. What we have is the ultimate test of phoniness. If you hold it as a principle of behavior, practice, morality, theology, that you always read the writings of St. Paul, their argument being this, that Jesus' words might be ambiguous, but St. Paul is elaborating and teaching, and that is what they hold, then you must go by the clear teachings of St. Paul. But I also use this analogy. If a man only read the Gospel of St. Luke, would he get the truth from Christ? Yes. Does he make any ambiguity in St. Luke? No. So why, if you have 9 passages absolutely forbidding divorce, and one which can be twisted in certain ways for a certain understanding, why would you not take the 8 as opposed to the 9? Because they simply wish to have sins of the flesh concelebrated again in their own church and make a mockery of God. That's exactly the point. There are no theological bases for this. None whatsoever. The reason they argue that the real presence isn't true, among other reasons, is because St. Paul never says it the way Jesus said it. If Jesus really meant it, St. Paul would have repeated it. See, this is where I must claim expertise. I read Protestant, and I repeat it, no exceptions. We'll always quote St. Paul, even to the point that Protestants don't even know that Jesus was asked the question, what must I do to be saved? They say he was never asked the question, when of course we know he was. Why? Because the messages in St. Paul are confusing, difficult, and ambiguous, and one-sided. They can distort them, as St. Peter says, to their own destruction. But the teachings of Jesus are very clear. Obey the commandments. That goes against all Protestantism, so they throw Jesus out. And there's my point. Every time Jesus is asked, what must I do to be saved, he talks about necessary works. Every time. Yet the Protestant will tell you, you don't have to do anything. Now, throw out even the thing about remarriage and divorce. Go up to a Protestant and say, what must I do to be saved? And they will never give you Jesus' answer. Obey the commandments. They will never give you that. How could you possibly call yourself a good Christian and be in that system? And that is exactly why I pointed out. And I say it again, Jerry Matatich, to his own, to his own credit, did not, when he was asked exactly this on invincible ignorance, says he does not accept the term, and he was ignorant, but not invincibly so. He was culpably ignorant. Comment, if you want.
Well, I want to say this, that the Matatich, I know a lot of Protestants who are converted, Scott Hanna, of course, and every one of them says that such has been their background, such has been their cultural background, that any other possibility is thinkable except that Rome should be the true church. It was a pure lightning knocking them off the horse that they should accept Rome. I therefore say that you seem to defy the word of Isaiah that there's a road and you bruise it and there's a little smoldering wick, and instead of seeming to encourage the bruised reed or the smoldering wick, you seem to shove it aside as if it's as clear as Euclid's geometry that the Roman Catholic Church is the true church. So I think that's counterproductive, quite apart from anything else now.
Okay. You're right in what you say. I do that for two reasons. Several reasons. One is, I do not know if I have a long-term relationship with a person. If I meet him on Monday, and he dies on Tuesday, and I did not invite him into the church under penalty of his own salvation, then I have a horrible judgment when I stand in front of the judgment seat. If you can guarantee me, with papal infallibility certitude, that a person's going to live for 10 years and I'm going to live for 10 years, I might think of your approach. But I might be dead tomorrow. And to not have confronted the person at that point, number one, is a judgment I don't wish to face. I'd much rather face the judgment if I said too much and said it too often than I said it too little. maybe that's one of the reasons why we have things repeated in the Gospels sometimes three or four times. Certainly, Jesus only has to say it once to know what happened and the principle involved. That's number one. Number two is this. I work on a very radical premise, that I've been called to do what I do, and there are no coincidences in life. In other words, every single human being who is put into my path is put in there for a reason. If they're not supposed to be there, God will make sure they don't show up. Which means I then speak from my heart, and my heart says this, Vin, the words you say when you suspend your will and when you speak from your heart will strike exactly in the heart of this person, and something you say will have been prepped to hear before. I tell this story frequently, I'll tell it very briefly. I'm at a pro-life dinner. I meet someone who tells me she's a born-again Christian. To make a long story short, I said, are you a Catholic? She says, no. I said, then you're not only not born again, but you're on your way to hell. Long story short, I had a long-term relationship with this woman, trying to talk her into the church through every intellectual possibility I could, and I failed ultimately, although she came into the church. You don't talk anybody into a matter of conversion. But she did tell me later that a priest had worked on her before I had spoken to her, and the priest had warned her essentially the same thing. And before she met me, she said to God, God, if the Catholic Church is true, give me an unmistakable clear sign. I was the unmistakable clear sign. I couldn't have possibly been anything else, because God prepped the way. St. John said, prepare you the way of the Lord. God says, I will prepare the way for you, because if you act in my behalf, I will do 99+999%. You do the rest. The rest is to take the act of will and function in faith that what you will say is the right thing. Does not mean to say that every time I say things, it is the right thing. But sometimes it is when I speak from my heart, and that is when I suspend my own will and let God use me, and I claim utterly that this happens very frequently because it's an easy thing to do. And the last point I would make is, if we go by scriptural examples, and I think we have to, we have the situation in at least two instances where Jesus called people immediately and they didn't come. And, you know, come, I went, I'm sorry, I've got to go bury my father, and come, I just, you know, I'll be with you in a moment. No, he who puts his hands to the plow and looks back is not worthy of me. And then we have the situation where he said it to St. Peter, and St. Peter dropped his stuff and walked. Now, he didn't say, excuse me, I have to get a co-signer on this, let me turn this over, let me get someone to watch my boats. He dropped everything, and he followed them. Same with Matthew, Levi. What I'm saying is, if we work on the scriptural example that at least sometimes this is good, then it cannot be counterproductive. Now, I think what you're doing is, and I think it's a perfectly natural thing to do, but a perfectly wrong thing to do, is you're judging this from the same situation of selling insurance. But if you say to someone, you need insurance because you're going to die and you leave your wives, kids, they'll all be miserable and unhappy, you bum by the insurance, yeah, you'll throw the guy out. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a guardian angel that whispers in his ear before I get there. And we're talking about a blessed mother who intercedes daily for him. And we're talking about a Jesus who died on the cross and went through all that agony for him, so that at that moment, I would be in that place, at that time, not by coincidence, but to act as a rung, to bring him higher to ultimately come into the church. And if I fail to bring the seriousness of this to him, my view, this is now my opinion, I believe that what I've done is show no act of charity to him. To me, it's the concept of the same thing as AIDS. You say to the homosexual community, if you guys continue to carry on your habits, well, gee whiz, there's a possibility you might get AIDS, but you know, if you have safe sex and if you do these other things and get blood tests, don't worry about it too much. I don't think that's an act of love for the homosexuals. I think if you say, if you continue to do this, you'll die horrifying deaths and probably go to hell, stop immediately now, then I think that's an act of love. And if we consider abortion the issue that we do, no compromise, and contraception, no compromise, and other acts, no compromise, then is not much worse than that the disbelief from which everything flows. Because to disbelieve is exactly what these people are doing. They're saying, yes, Ben, I can understand what you're saying. That's a reasonable argument. I'll think about it. And I say, ask God right now. Ask God.
I got it right out.
No. Oh, cool. Okay, fine. Thank you, gentlemen. I hope I can summarize it briefly. What I said was that I see a supernatural aspect in what I do, and that God provides the opportunity, the environment, the circumstances for me to say the correct thing. And to say that the direct approach is counterproductive actually denies the supernatural aspect of God in man. That's my basic position.
I'm willing to admit that God can write straight with crooked line. God can take the stones and make children of Abraham out of them. And you're perfectly right that given an individual's background, it may be that coming across here and you with your intangible direct confrontation, this was exactly what this person needed. And it may be you will help this man get to heaven, and therefore your soul will be saved. But as a general principle, I don't think it's the only way. I don't think it's the best way. And above all, I don't think it's the only way. And I think if I had my choice, if I had a Protestant friend of mine who is in trouble, who is confused about doctrine and all that, if I had my choice of introducing him to you or to Jerry Mattis, I would introduce him to Jerry, because I would be afraid that, I'm not afraid of truth, but I would be afraid of tactlessness, I would be afraid of genuine insensitivity, and you might crush the smoldering wick. That's my general criticism of you. And I think Jerry has at least as much competence in biblical matters, and he's come up through something a long, long way, and he has an ability to sympathize more. You almost act as if no matter what culture a person comes from, it's instantly imputable to him that he is embracing an error. And I am much more lackadaisical. You could say I'm theologically lazy, but I get much more time for a kind of gestation period before the Word of God grips a human soul.
I don't wish to compare myself to Jerry because I don't think it would be appropriate, but I would only say this, that the criticism that Jerry leveled against me was not that I say people are going to hell. He said, always tell them they're going to hell before you leave them. But don't lead off with it. Say it towards the end of the conversation. Now, if that's your definition of tact, I agree with that. But Jerry says, always make sure you tell them they're going to hell, because you have to tell them they're going to hell. But again, only later. I would accuse you of being theologically lazy. Again, I simply say this. If I function in good will, now, you don't even have to say I function in good will. You can accuse me of bad will. So let's make it hypothetical. If I function in good will, and if I say, Lord, make me an instrument of your will, and then I say, put in my path those people with whom or to whom I can be an instrument of truth, then God will do that, because God will not frustrate a good intention. And then, and I point this out, that my experience with Protestants is far more vast than anybody else in this country, without exception. Jerry Mattis, Scott Hahn, others were Protestants. But they were Protestants trying to justify Protestantism or searching in their own truth. They were not dealing with the concepts of conversion, apologetics, and presentation of truth to a Protestant personality. I know more about the Protestant personality. I know more about what makes a Protestant tick. I know more about what makes Protestantism alluring than anybody else in the country, without doubt. Because I immersed myself in it with objective scholarship for an awful long time. And that is why I can predict with complete and utter validity what people will say before they say it. And hundreds of people tell me this when they write back to me and say, your book was of great help because. when you said that they will say this, they said it exactly. It worked exactly as you said, the ultimate degree of predictability. My point is simply this. My approach is not based on a personality defect. In fact, I would much rather be the gentle, wishy-washy, wimpy approach of suggesting. That's my natural personality. What I've done is remade myself by the grace of God into something else. Because number one, although my current way works very little numerical wise, the other way worked not at all. Zero. So I have a very, very small success rate on being instrumental in bringing people into the church by being confrontational. But I have an absolute zero rate on being suggestive and kind and everything else. To my knowledge, as I've said many times, match numbers with me. I say this to any of my critics, match numbers with me. There are no numbers. So you bring your car to my shop and I fix it 1 out of 10 times. You bring your car to the other guy's shop, out of 250 times, it's never worked. Who are you going to go to?
This is a question of fact. There are, in fact, significant Protestants coming into the church, not thanks to Benny Lewis. So apparently somebody out there is doing something besides Benny Lewis, getting serious Protestants into the church. And I just wonder if we had someone like Cardinal Newman in his Oxford days, how Benny Lewis could have answered Cardinal Newman. He said the prayer, Lead Conley Life. He is in good faith. He knew that he said that I have not sinned against life, therefore he believes that God will save him. But it took him an awful long time before he could conceive. That's because sociologically and psychologically speaking, his milieu has convinced him that Rome is the whore of Babylon. And just the way you and I have our own childhood prejudices, so I'm not all that thankful. No, I don't know. How is it? God bless, boy. Good to see you.
I understand perfectly what you're saying, but if you know the conversion story of both Scott Hahn and Jerry Matatix, to simply use those examples, neither one was led into the church by any Catholic whatsoever. Nobody worked on them. As a matter of fact, if you listen to their conversion stories, and I've listened to both, I even produced one with Jerry, when they came to Catholic priests to ask to come in, the Catholic priests told them to stay out. And that delayed their conversion. To my knowledge, although I may be wrong, none of the alleged famous conversions have been brought in by anybody. That's number one. Number two, I do not convert anybody. I try to be careful in my language. There are some people who I think attribute to me a certain degree of instrumentality. What I simply say is, if other people claim that they have also removed stumbling blocks from people, let them come and confront me. Fine. Then we're talking statistics versus statistics, credentials versus credentials. I don't hear that. I don't see that. And those few people who even alluded to it, I confront them and I say, let's do it. And they avoid the issue. I go by 1 Thessalonians, the reading today. Test everything, keep what's good. I'm quite willing to test things and keep what is good. What I find is when I test myself, I work, I succeed. I had a debate approximately a week ago in Illinois on the Immaculate Conception, and before I began, I took a vow that if they showed me one thing wrong with my position from their King James Version of the Bible, I would convert on the spot. One thing wrong. Now, you make
an argument for Protestant?
Yes. From the King James Version of the Bible, and I cannot bring up anything. They set up all the conditions, three of them. I had to use their version of the King James Version. I had to use their book. I couldn't even bring my King James Version. Only the Bible and the Immaculate Conception. And I took the vow beforehand that if they showed me one thing wrong, I would convert. Now, you may find this a radical, abrupt, silly argument, rather extreme, but I would point out to you that the only reason I have any relationship with Jerry Matatix at all is because he heard me do this once, and he called up to find the exact wording of my oath because he thought it was a marvelous technique to bet your salvation on every single time you contend for the faith. Because if you lose, you have to leave the church, and you're on your way to hell, and you know it. call on God that much, like Elijah. But the thing about Newman, I think, is a good point. So that's good. He's dead. We don't have to get into personalities. What I hold is simply this, that Cardinal Newman, before he became Cardinal Newman, could have, at any moment he chose to, discovered the truth of his position or the error of position, and did not do so. Instead, what he did was, like Matatix and Hahn, he spent an awful lot of time not seeking the truth whatsoever, but simply trying to buttress the position he came from. You're perfectly right. That's due to cultural, environmental, psychological habits. But we also call it prejudice. And the cultural, environmental, and psychological habits are what we call original sin. And the first words of Jesus in the Gospel of St. Mark, if I remember correctly, are, "Repent, reform, the kingdom of God is at hand." He spoke to religious Jews who were following the Mosaic law, breaking up into different groups, arguing over exactly how to follow it, and their basic objection to him, as I can see, was, "Who are you to tell us this? But also, how dare you tell us to replace something that is good on your evidence alone?" And what was his ultimate answer was, "Seek your heart. Listen, and you'll know." He was confrontational at times, but he never got into lengthy discussions, except in the Gospel of St. John, starting in chapter 8, in which there's lengthy theological discussions, in which Jesus engages in a great deal of name-calling. He calls them liars, sons of Satan, etc. And, of course, they tried to kill him at the end of that. And I'll also point out to you again that when Jesus says, "Don't we'll give what is holy to dogs, or cast your pearls before swine," he was calling people dogs and swine. I don't get that harsh. Now, if you want to say I'm not Christ-like enough, right. I've never called a person, I alluded to one Catholic once as a swine in this exact situation, but I've never called a Protestant a dog or a pig. But Jesus called unbelievers dogs and pigs. I'm not better than he is, and that means there's a time for it. And again, if we go back to the scripture, we don't see lengthy synergistic arguments, and we don't see Lee kindly light, and we don't say this. What we see is a complete and utter, "If you think of your mother more important than I, if you love your father more important than I am, then you're not worthy of me. Go to hell," literally. And what I'm saying is that's very abrupt, it's very extreme. Now, the thing about Newman, I'm simply saying, is this. Until Newman accepted Catholicism, he was an error. Culpable error. Simply because, let's go back to it again, the Bible clearly teaches, and if Newman was any kind of a scripture scholar at all, he knew this, that divorce and remarriages are not allowed, and he knew that his entire system was based on a divorce. He was an Anglican. It was conceived in evil. It was founded by this sephitic monster, Henry VIII, who was one of the most immoral men who ever lived. His right-hand man was Cranmer, one of the second most immoral men who ever lived. He knows that they put to death people endlessly for no reason whatsoever other than they were Catholics. He knows that the only reason Queen Elizabeth became queen was because she swore on her coronation to uphold the Church of Rome and the Catholic teachings, and then immediately betrayed it, and then made the break even more firm and final and absolute. Now, if Newman knew that, and he had to know that, or he was exceptionally ignorant or extremely blind, then what he knew was this. Jesus says, good tree comes from a good tree fruit, the good tree produces good fruit, and vice versa. You have horrible trees in the Church of England. It is a horrible, blasphemous perversion of Christianity from its very beginning until its entire time at the end. The coronation oath of the kings of England up until recently included the following. I will uphold the Constitution or whatever it is and accept kingship, and also there is no such thing as transubstantiation. The actual words require, until recently, an anti-transubstantiation position. And again, as an Anglican, if you knew anything about Scripture, you knew that transubstantiation is just a fancy word for what Jesus said. Now, you can argue that somehow he was blind to this. I agree. But he was blind because of the original sin that he refused to exclude from his heart. And because he might have written some nice poems, and even meant them in a certain sense, doesn't mean he was willing to accept the conclusion. I point out again, St. Augustine, who I hold to be a much greater man than Cardinal Newman, because he's canonized and because of his character and his mind, prayed after his conversion, Lord, make me chaste, give me the strength for it, but not this year. Now, a man like that admitting that he was still troubled by chastity problems, and in a sense probably meant the prayer he meant, Lord, straighten me out sometimes before I die, but allow me to fool around now. That man was admitting the nature of original sin, while it appears to me Cardinal Newman was essentially denying it. And again, in a choice between a canonized saint and a doctor of the church and a man who we have no outward evidence yet is in heaven, I would go for the canonized saint. I see this perpetually all the way through. I see through the gospel, not the gospels, but the Old Testament particularly, about the sinful nature of man, his sinful desires leading him to his own destruction, the nature of original sin. That is what causes earthly cultures, earthly environments, earthly inclinations, earthly psychological impediments to come. And that is why what a man should do is exactly what I tell people to do when I remember to do it. I should always remember to do it. Is, all right, you didn't accept my argument, you didn't think this, you didn't think that. Tonight, get down on your knees and say with full heart, Lord, show me the truth. Like that girl did the day a short time before I met her. Because God, and then I say, look for a sign, because God guaranteed it will give you a sign. Guaranteed will give you a sign. Any man who seeks the truth will find it. And if it takes him a long time to find it, and I remember reading a long time ago Cardinal Newman's Apologia, but it seemed to me he took a long time trying to find a middle ground. That's a whole lot different from trying to find the truth. If you try to find a middle ground, what you're saying is I don't want to go all the way. I don't necessarily want to stay where I am. I'm looking for a political compromise. If you say instead, I want to follow the truth wherever it leads me, that's a different story. And I could be wrong, but I never saw him say that. I see this gradual wearing away of difficulties, but each time it was like with Matatix and Hahn, a desire to prove their previous belief rather than any desire to find the truth. One of the things
at this time, please turn to side two where the discussion will continue. Mara and Lewis, Christmas, 1993. Discussion, side two. The discussion continues.
Don't look where things are going. Just look at the immediate now. Yes, well, it was because the reason was they understood that what was preventing them from following things through to conclusion is that it was leading to Catholicism. And Catholicism bent, and thanks to their cultural background, Catholicism represented a whole of Babylon and Antichrist. And it's not easy to repudiate your childhood. It's not easy to repudiate it. I utterly agree. It might even be, in a very real sense, impossible. But as Jesus says clearly, and as the angel says to the Blessed Mother at the time of the Annunciation, with God all things are possible. Or, that's why I go back to it again. If I make the act of will to do what God wills, then if it is in my benefit for it to do so, or the benefit of the salvation of someone else, He will provide the means. No two ways about it. And what I'm saying is, that is what I am offering here. That's my position. That is my statement. That is my belief. That the cultural impediments will fall away like the scales before St. Paul's eyes. Once again, the road to Damascus situation. You're familiar with Richard Cadden, the writer, Richard Cadden Grillo? His conversion story took place like that. Nobody talked him into it. He became a Catholic before he fully understood what it meant to be a Catholic, because he called a priest who he trusted and said, I am now going to be a Catholic. I have to be a Catholic. God has told me. It wasn't any intellectual arguments. And I know at least one other person that this happened to. And outside of St. Paul, of course. And the guy said, well, so light candles in front of statues and everything else will follow. And I thought it was a great, great story and a great, really profound truth. All the impediments that Richard Calogrido had, he removed because he understood the nature of truth and the nature of his obligation to it. Anybody who understands the nature of truth, I gave a talk on this just the other night, a value is something that is worth obtaining, and it is something that you will forego something else for. So if the value of a loaf of bread is more to you than a dollar, you will forego the dollar to take the loaf of bread. Any man who puts his value system correctly, which is just another way of saying is committed to the truth, will understand that the ultimate value on earth is truth, because without truth you cannot achieve salvation or know how to please God or know what to repent for. And he who seeks truth disinterestedly, without prejudice, will in fact find it. He who seeks truth to only reinforce his view is by definition, if you disagree, tell me, by definition in bad will, is by definition in sin, is by definition committing the sin of Adam again. Thank you for your truths, God. I will accept exactly what I find comfortable and not accept exactly what I find comfortable, and I will remake right and wrong in my own image. It's the ultimate Protestant sin. They cannot say to our Father, thy will, not my will, be done, because my will is that I don't join this war of Babylon and that I remain in this apostate Protestant church, that where everybody does what they want, where truth has no value, where there is no way to get your sins forgiven, where there are no sins, where no one can determine anything, and yet I call this truth. Again, they violate the first commandment. Thou shalt not have strange gods before me, because their God is their belly and their book. And they violate the second commandment, because they take the name of the Lord in vain. They call upon Jesus, they call him Christ, and they say, enlighten us, but they don't mean it. They say, show us the truth, but they don't mean it. That is why I say, with sincere heart, show me the position where I'm wrong when I debate you, Mr. Protestant, and I will abandon my church immediately. Are you willing to do that? Now, none of them are. Because, you see, you're right. Their environmental positions hold that. There's nothing wrong with being a rooting of a team until the last minute, even though you know your team is going to lose, because that's just an emotional factor. But if the emotional factors are more important than the abstract truth that leads you to God, that's sin. And every Protestant has to be that way, because every Protestant, as soon as he has read the Bible, after having reached the age of reason, sees massive, massive defects. Not just on their marriage and divorce, but on forgiveness.
I want to join this group. Do you know if anyone else?
Not yet.
Yeah,
because
I'm not choice.
Yeah,
I'm not
your choice,
and I'm people
with you. Well, Bimmy and I have known this thing recorded. Well, this is so that I don't forget what I said, because I have a bad memory. But Bimmy and I have known each other for at least 6-7 years now, I think. At this place, and
I was a young man then, and he was older.
Yeah. But Benny has been a state trooper, and now he is a single-minded, and I might even say zealot,
fanatical
for Christian apologetics, and we've had a little collision. Catholic? He's a super Catholic.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. I'm not sure.
Okay, yeah. So, the one who wrote me a letter recently in which he, in a sense, confronted me that if I find nothing fundamentally wrong with your approach, I have the duty to support you in whatever way. Support you could be financially, could also be putting you on my radio show and so on. Ben?
Financially is the least thing, but that's
important. Okay. Now, first of all, you seem to think that because Christ was uncompromising, it suffices that you want to do the will of Christ and that you could speak with the same prophetic absolute as if you speak with authority, but you're not Christ. So there's something that the God-man, perfect in divinity, perfect in humanity, should confront people as one thing, who reads every heart, that you should confront. May I say, sometimes the providence of God will allow that your harsh, direct confrontational approach may bear fruit. But I don't think it necessarily bears fruit, and I think that in certain ways you are going to delay or postpone or prevent people of sincere heart. They're going to think you're just a crazy, one obsessed fanatic.
What are the two qualities that Jesus
himself has
got the
value
of?
to meek and humble of heart.
Yeah.
And well, I don't know, would Benny, why, do you want to accuse yourself of being meek and humble of heart?
Utterly! I'm probably the most meek and humble of heart person I've ever met. No, I'm deadly serious, and I'm glad you brought it up because it's exactly my point. I do not speak with my own authority, but I speak with the utter authority of Christ when I say the following. My mother was immaculately conceived. She was a virgin all her life. She was assumed into heaven, and if you don't believe that, you go to hell. Now, if you think I, Vinnie Lewis, am saying that, then you are foolish, because I just said it's not my authority at all. I take no claim for authority for that. I claim to be a best, a hand puppet on the hand of God. But I also say this, unless I can proclaim the gospel truth with absolute certainty of never being wrong, then this church is a farce, and Jesus died for nothing, and his words that everyone committed to the truth hears his voice, and that his followers will know the truth and be set free from sin by it are lies. So it is the utter act of humility to be able to say something with complete and utter, unqualified, infallible authority, and not on your own, because I become, at best, the willing instrument of God. And I point out to you that simple syllogism, if it's wrong, don't dodge it, tell me, don't comment, answer the syllogism. If disbelief is a sin, and if it is a spiritual work of mercy to admonish the sinners, then how could it possibly be wrong to admonish a person who is disbelieving? Because without faith, it is impossible to please God, according to several councils and St. Paul in the inspired word of God. I repeat it again, major premise. Disbelief is a sin which will put you in hell. Minor premise, it is a valid thing to admonish sinners. Conclusion, it is a perfectly valid thing and a perfectly admirable thing and meritorious thing and indulgence-producing thing to admonish sinners. And then question, what is it that I am doing other than admonishing sinners? In an utter and complete humility, because I never say follow me, and I never say it's my voice, and I never tell anybody that I am skilled in doing this in the way no one else can. If anybody reads my literature, and if anybody listens to my instructional tapes, what I tell them is the same thing I tell Jerry Matatix. Get your salvation in every single moment that you debate, because God will put the words into your mouth. You don't need to know scholarship, and you don't need to know the Bible, and you don't need to know this, because if you did, then it would just be mind against mind, brain against brain, scholarship against scholarship, and in that I lose probably every time. But if I bet God against him, how can I fail? Because if God was with us, who can be against us? And in that sense, I claim to be the most meek and the most humble of any person I've ever met, and that is not pride. That is simply acknowledgement of the fact. I make myself a willing instrument of my will, I suspend my belief, and I say, God, give me, in a certain sense, a variation of the gift of tongues. Let me speak and say the right words. And I point out again, when I admonished that girl who later came into the church, because she asked for that sign, I was a humble instrument in the hands of God, and we can all do that. But answer my syllogism, if you would. Well, first of all, if you contented yourself with saying that Mary was immaculately conceived, that every line from your mouth was a de fide doctrine of the Catholic Church, obviously you have at the mouthpiece of God, but I claim you go much further than that. You have particular judgment about this or that man, which is not de fide, that's number one. And then you seem to think you are the only show in town, or at least the best show in town, and I simply deny that. I mean, I simply don't think you're that effective. Also, when it comes to scholarship and all that, it seems you have this simplistic syllogism. Jesus, in good faith, I submit to you, and I pray that the next time I open my mouth, it's not I who speak, but you who speak. And having said that, you have kind of total. It may well be that
you're deceiving yourself, and you have a kind of simplistic syllogism, and when you speak, you think because of your dedication and your prayer that everything that comes out is God, but it may be Vinny Lewis who is there to human. Now, I remember in this very room a year or two ago, you were talking about the inefficacy of prayer, that when St. Monica prayed for St. Augustine, in no way did her prayer have any impact on Augustine. Was that a good memory or not?
It's close.
Margaret was dead wrong. I think you're in heresy on that, yeah. So, how could I credit you with speaking with God's voice when it seems to me, from my understanding of what God says, that prayer is efficacious, that's part of the mercy of God. If my son is wayward, my prayers can avail to give him the graces to be saved.
I'll answer that in a second, but I'll come back to it again. The syllogism of the mind, first of all, I'm not the only show in town, and I hope you didn't think I said that. Okay. Yes, but I'm not the only show in town. Number two, when I do debate, I don't debate Vinnie Lewis. I debate things like the Immaculate Conception, which is the true church, whether the Protestant revolt could be justified, the real presence, whether veneration of the Blessed Mother is allowed by the Bible, etc. I do not debate whether Vinnie Lewis is better than the Protestant. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't debate whether Vinnie Lewis is better than somebody else. Not interested in that either. I debate purely dogmatic matters versus the exact opposite. So in that case, I am debating pure truth versus falsity. All right. But the point is, and I'll deal with the efficacy of the prayer in a moment. I think I can satisfy your answer in a moment. But the point is, please answer the thing on syllogism. If disbelief is a sin, and if I admonish the disbeliever, how could you say that that is not a meritorious act, or am I misunderstanding you?
I realize I'm going to sound like a Jesuit, but that someone does not believe in the Roman Catholic Church as the unique, true Church of God is objectively a sin. I say subjectively because of all the historical commission, it may in no way be imputed to them, least of all to the poor religious illiterate who come along. But even to the very educated people like Cardinal Newman and the Saint Mary Jerry Monitor, if they have been in season and out of season programmed to believe that the one thing impossible to be true is Roman Catholicism, I think it takes an extreme creature, an extreme confronter who might need all sorts of talk, which is not necessarily the gift of Billy Lewis, to bring them out of that.
Okay, let me make a point on the nature. I'll make one point, then I'll go to the prayer. If the Protestant is in good faith, in other words, if Jerry Maddox and Scott Hahn believed what they were taught, then they could not believe what they were taught. Okay, it seems like a paradox. The Protestantism is a paradox. Because Protestantism says, officially, that each preacher gets up. Don't believe me, I'm a simple, corrupt man who's likely to tell you a lie. Don't believe him. He's a simple, corrupt man likely to believe a lie. Everybody's a simple and corrupt man likely to believe a lie. And no man knows the truth, and nobody can give you correct information. That's a basic Protestant tenet. Universal priesthood confines the tenet of depravity. So therefore, if Jerry Maddox and Scott Hahn gave consent to that, then they must automatically disbelieve anything bad said about Catholicism because it comes to them through a tainted source. So in other words, to remain a Protestant, you must go against the basic premise of Protestantism, which means you must remain in it in bad faith. No alternative, no choice. The nature of Protestantism is this. Truth is impossible. Nobody knows anything in religious matters at all, without qualification, utter absolute, and then adds that the Roman Catholic Church is wrong. The most truth cannot be held at the same time. No man who gives faith can, and that is why no man who gives faith can be a Protestant. But that's my basic premise. You should understand the nature of it well over your mind. The point is, about the thing with the prayer, is this. I simply say the following. If St. Monica had died in giving birth to St. Augustine, that would not have put him into hell. What I'm saying is that the prayers of St. Monica did not put him into heaven. Our salvation is from the man God Jesus who died on the cross. And no other human being puts us into heaven or puts us into hell, period. Well, he does use human instruments, such as priests to confess us, to baptize us, to give us the body of Christ. We certainly have a sacramental system. And you could argue from a certain surface causal effect that the man who baptized me is instrumental for my salvation, and the same ones the priest who gives me my last confession and absolves me of my last mortal sin is instrumental in my salvation, and I couldn't be saved without him. But in fact, God would have found another replaceable human being to achieve my salvation. And what I'm saying again is this, to summarize it. If St. Monica had never said a prayer for St. Augustine, he still would have been saved or damned by his own willingness to accept or reject the gift of salvation. When each man stands in front of the judgment seat, no man can say, Lord, I'm going to hell because this person didn't pray for me or that person didn't pray for me. Everybody has to say, I'm going to hell, Lord, because the opportunities you gave me, I clearly rejected of my own. It is a clear Catholic teaching, which I'm sure you have no problems with, that only a mortal sin puts you in hell. And a mortal sin has to be serious matter, clearly confronted, understood. For St. Augustine to have wound up in hell, it would have had to be something he did, and not something St. Monica did or did not do. And in that sense, I say that the efficacy of the prayer, as far as his salvation, of course has no relationship, in the same sense that nobody's prayer has any relationship with anybody else's salvation, as long as you understand that mortal sin puts you in hell, acceptance of God puts you in heaven, and that is not dependent on any other individual's actions, only your own. We all ultimately, to sound like the Protestant, develop our personal relationship with Jesus. It is God, if we maintain it after baptism, that puts us in heaven. It is the failure to maintain it that puts us in hell. And that's why I say it was ineffective. I said it was a shock value last year. I didn't get a chance to explain it. I hope I'm clear now. No, I don't know if you're clear or not, but the question would be, we have all kinds of wayward sons, and we have all kinds of mothers who are in despair, and I would tell a mother, let St. Monica be your mother, pray and fast and do penance for your son, and it may be that had you not done all this, he would have, to his own lack of freedom, gone to hell. But it may be that you were somehow going up the grace to spare him. You're going to tell the mother, don't worry, madam, if this man is going to freely choose heaven or hell, if you don't pray for him, someone else's instrumentality will do it. Well, how would you answer that?
To answer that, I would say definitely pray for him. I use the expression which I believe doesn't extend to you. I pray as if everything depends on God. I work as if everything depends on me. I dealt with this one time. There's paradoxes both in theology and in human nature, which if you present them from a purely physical point of view, human nature or the physical world, it seems absurd. And I'll give a very simple example which I think makes sense. The paradox in human nature. The Macedonians under Alexander the Great used to carry a spear that was approximately 24 to 28 feet long. Now, if you think about trying to carry that at one end, you can't. It's very difficult. It's massively impossible. Why? Because it simply weighs too much. So the problem is too much weight, because obviously if this thing was something like a soda straw that was 28 feet long, you wouldn't have a problem holding it. But it weighs too much. So how did they solve the problem? They made it weigh more by putting a counterbalance weight on the short end. Because it was too much weight, they made it heavier, and now it's manageable. A man who jumps off a sinking ship and sinks weighs too much. How do we make him stay afloat? By putting more weight on him in the form of a life preserver. Oh yes, it distributes his weight and he takes up more volume, but it actually weighs more. Too much weight you sink, more weight you float. Doesn't make sense, does it? Well, yeah, it does, okay? the Bumblebee and the other fools, and there's a lot of physical paradoxes. But I'm also saying is this example. Jesus clearly tells us that you are required to feed the hungry and clothe the naked. And notice he says, to the least of my brethren, which implies one can make an argument that this basic Christian charity is to be extended to other Christians, not necessarily to the entire world. So you must take care of those in whom you see the image of Christ, who are made in the image of Christ by their baptism. Okay, let's argue that, just as a restricted point. But does not Jesus also say to all of us, his, those who are made in his image and baptism, don't worry about what you need, don't worry about what you're going to wear, I'll take care of it. Father in heaven knows about these things. Look at the lilies of the field. What do we have? We have two completely opposite principles. Number one, you ought to feed the hungry, clothe the naked. Number two, God will do it. Don't worry about it. Well, listen, one of the things I think we have an obligation to do is to literally call on one another in charity. It's one of the things I did with the letter. If I am hungry and you have excess food, I think I have an obligation to give you the opportunity to do good. But the point is, you could very well argue to me that Jesus says, he'll take care of the food and stuff. Yes, he will. But he'll use you as the instrumentality. What I'm saying is this. If in God's plan, somehow prayer is necessary for salvation, then that prayer will be provided, even if it has to jump out of time, circle the earth and come back in time in the past ages. In other words, if it is necessary for me to be prayed for to be saved, and that could be part of salvation that I don't understand, then it could very well be that some Monica's excess prayers are for me, even though she wouldn't know it. And if she had died, somebody else would do the prayers, because I will not be kept out of heaven simply because of the actions or inactions of another person. But again, we have this paradox. Prayer is if everything depends on God, a perfectly meritorious thing. Work is if God doesn't exist, a perfectly meritorious thing. Which means you should spend time giving food to the hungry and clothes to the naked. But at the same time, you should also understand that when you go to bed at night, God is taking care of them. Don't let it bother you too much. Do what you can, do what you should, leave the rest to God. It is a meritorious thing to pray for someone's soul. And the other day, someone came up to me and said, my son has left the church. And I can understand from what you're saying that they destroyed his faith in this high school. And I said, I didn't destroy his faith. Everybody's responsible for their own loss of faith. And she says, but I feel responsible. And I said, you should feel responsible. Because even though he is, you should function as if it is totally up to you. Notice what I said before. I don't want to face judgment. Having said, I spoke to this guy on Monday. I didn't tell him the necessity of salvation coming into the church. And he died on Tuesday. Lord, I don't want to face that judgment. That does not mean for any means that I think I'm the only way he's going to get to heaven, that God needs me. No way. He doesn't need me. I need to do it because it's God's will. And it's God's will to pray for other people. And it's God's will all these things. And if we do enough of God's will, we get to heaven, we'll have less time in purgatory. But we cannot limit God simply by our prayer. God will do good for a person simply because, as Jesus tells us, Father in heaven knows what you already need. Don't worry about that. But we should pray anyway. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In a certain sense, what you're doing is confirming a reality, because understanding the concepts of the will of God, his will is going to be done on earth and in heaven. I don't criticize prayer. I hold fully with that, as it was St. Alphonsus Liguori, that prayer is one of the signs of those who will be saved. Agree with it totally. But I simply say that, and I always get into real problems with this, extra grace. If God gives every man sufficient grace to know the truth and come to a knowledge which will save him, then what's the extra? Well, I don't know. That's a problem. But it appears to me as if this is enough, then anything extra is not going to push you over the edge. It's like the teeter-totter. Once you put too much weight on one side, it hits the ground. If you continue to add more weight to that, it doesn't go down further. If God gives every man enough grace, and if God gave St. Augustine enough grace by his baptism and his early training to know the truth, then St. Monica's prayers might have added grace, but it couldn't have changed the basic nature of God's calling of St. Augustine. And that's my point. I don't criticize prayer. I simply say again, if St. Augustine had not prayed, he still would have been saved if he had lived the life he did with the belief he did. And again, we're never dependent on another human being. Our salvation has to be a gift, a supernatural gift from God. At best, humans are instruments, but it cannot be a necessary means that makes it a salvation by works, even if it's works by others. Hey, Robert, is that thing still on?
Yeah. I'm trying to recapitulate the original point. Again, I'm accusing you of too much of a transparent syllogism. You said the Protestants really believed that I'm only a finite, fallible human being, therefore I have nothing to say. Nevertheless, I, fallible, tell you that the Roman Catholic Church of the whole Babylon, you keep crediting people with a crystal clear intelligence, which is not even apparent in arithmetic class. If you even taught arithmetic, you found out that there's enormous confusion, even on such a simple thing as numbers, much more on this profound question of religious and moral truth. So I want to say the bottom line is this. Although you've given up all sorts of other enterprises and you're almost obsessed with this Catholic apologetic, and it would be useful if I were one of many, maybe 50 people who would give a little financial support if I give you some time on my radio program and all that. But then I want to say as a late Catholic, I say, I have so much time, I have so much money to help evangelization. Do I want a Benny Lewis talking to people? Do I want a Jerry Madison for a Scott Hammer or Father Michele or Bill Maher? And I in no way feel any special obligation to single you out. Now, if you're one of the least of Christ's brethren in the sense of being a destitute, whether you have anything to say evangelistically or not, then obviously I have some sort of an obligation, as I do to the next drunkard whom I meet on the street. But you seem to say, because you're so convinced of your evangelical vocation, that I should pay attention to that, and I'm not convinced.
That is in a very real sense a perfectly valid argument. You are not obligated in any way to support me, even if I am the best. Even if I were the best, you are not in any obligation, I believe, I hold, you're not in any obligation to support me through the exclusivity of supporting other people who do good things. I agree readily. What I hold is two things, however. Number one, since there are no coincidences, since we tend to run into one another, and since geographically we're closer, I believe there's a reason for that. The reason that you have the inconvenience of contacting the other people, there's a reason for that too. Perhaps they're too busy. Perhaps God is putting up impediments to show you something. There are no coincidences, okay? I make myself available, I make myself convenient, and there's a matter of prudence here. If what I'm doing is right, even if not the best, and it is more easy for you to support me as opposed to the best, then you fulfill your obligation by taking the easy way, and your time is limited, and so is your goodwill, and just your energy. I agree perfectly. So what I'm saying is, one of the arguments in favor of me is utter convenience. I'm a short distance away, I'm far more available, far more convenient. But you said something utterly wrong. It is not that Protestants say they are fallible people. It is that they say they are evil people. You don't understand the nature of Protestantism. Protestantism advocates that human beings are evil. Not impaired, not crippled as a result of original sin, evil. Human beings are evil. Human beings are born justifiably worthwhile to put into hell. Protestants hold that everything a man does is evil until God regenerates him, and even then, 98% of what he does is evil. I'll say it again, evil. This is like us saying, well, you know, the abortionist is all right most of the times when he's including abortion. It's only the ones that are after the third month that are wrong. No. Every abortion is evil. The Protestant clearly states that man can know no truth. The Protestant clearly states that he can do no good. The Protestant clearly states that he is vile, corrupt, even after regeneration. The example is, again, Luther. Man is a pile of filth covered over by snow. As long as the snow is there, you can't smell the stink, and you can't see this junk, this filth, this excrement. But that's all man really is, and he never, ever, ever, ever changes. If a man gets up and says, you must not trust anything I say, if you accept that statement, from then on you will trust nothing of what he says. Every Protestant theological position is based on the principle that no man is trustworthy whatsoever. It's not fallible. There's a big difference. Fallible means can make a mistake. The Protestant personality position is man is evil. Evil. And what he will do is lie. What he will do is cheat. What he will do is be cruel and avaricious and dishonest. That is the Protestant position. If Jerry Maddox and Scott Horn believe that, and I'm not saying they ever did, but any Protestant who believes that must immediately reject everything he learns from his man, and that is the only, in a sense, consistent part of Protestantism, is the universal truth that every man goes directly to God and not through any other man. You learn from the Bible and the Spirit within you. You learn from no other man because he's corrupt, evil, and will mislead you, guaranteed 100%. You do not look for faithfulness from a prostitute. You do not go to a prostitute, give her money, have sex with her, and then say, now be faithful with me until I come back 2 months from now. You don't expect that. Even if she says that, you wouldn't expect it. The Protestant sees himself officially, whether they believe it or not, I can't say, but officially, every teacher in Protestantism is a prostitute who is betraying God with every word. Again, if you ask them the justification for their degrees in their Bible colleges, they have none. Because they are frank with you, they will say, we do it only because it impresses people. They believe that no man can teach another man, no man can know truth, no man can convey truth, period. And that's the point I'm making. It's an immense difference from I make mistakes to I can't ever get it right. You mentioned before about mathematics. You don't take some mongoloid, retarded child with an IQ of 7 who barely can function and ask them to teach mathematics. You don't. Or even understand mathematics. Or even show up in class. You don't. The Protestant holds that every human being is like that. Every human being is like that. So therefore, to teach in a Protestant system is to automatically destroy the Protestant position. And of course, they don't want to have jobs without heavy lifting. Okay, please, question.
As I stated in the beginning, the tape ends rather abruptly. This is the end. We were unable to resume the conversation simply because I had to leave and Bill Mara was unable to ignore any longer his social obligations to his other guests. When we did leave, I suggested to him the following, what I guess might be considered a compromise. One would be that he approach a third party in whom we both had faith and ask that third party's opinion of whether he should, quote, support me, unquote, or not. And the second thing was that he might make a tentative or conditional type of endorsement to the effect of using me or endorsing me or in recommending me in those areas in which I am skilled, but not necessarily endorsing my style, approach, etc. In other words, perhaps endorsing me as a technician in finding verses in the Bible for which one can build an argument establishing Catholicism. In other words, the technical aspects, the raw material of apologetics and evangelism, rather than the techniques of presentation. That's, in essence, where it ended. Whether that will come about at this time, I cannot say. I will simply say that, as of yet, I have not been contacted to appear on Bill Maher's radio show or any other forum which he manages. However, I must again repeat that he has in the past acted as a sponsor for ARM and for me and for that may God bless him. He's done much, much more than most other people who know of me, and he's done much, much more than most of the other, quote, named Catholics who know of me and my efforts. So for that, he deserves God's blessing and his grace. And I would simply like to acknowledge at this time his moral courage and his graciousness for inviting me over his house and having the willingness to bring up the subject and discuss it in an open manner. To again make an obvious point, this tape is a production of All Roads Ministry, ARM. You may obtain additional copies of this or any other tape which you feel of that might be of interest to you, including the previous Mara Christmas Party, Christmas 1992, by contacting us. You may write us at ARM 55 Palin, that's P as in papacy, A-L-E-N, Road, number 38, Hope Well Junction, New York, 12533. Hope Well is one word, Junction is a separate word. I hope you've gained something from this discussion. I hope you've enjoyed it. Hope the background noise wasn't too distracting. And I thank you for listening. God bless. Keep in touch.